Thanks, Risa. So as we've heard many times this morning and throughout the conference, our standard cosmological paradigm has had many opportunities to fail, especially in the context of things to do with the growth of structure, clusters of galaxies in particular. I'll emphasize here, of course, for this meeting, because we have these strong geometric tests on the expansion history of the universe that basically predict what we should see in our other observables due to the growth of structure. And this is interesting because it's testing the gravitational aspects, the force law aspects, of what we think is the dominant contributions of matter energy in the universe, the dark energy and the dark matter. So as we've seen this morning, the pink elephants can falsify our standard cosmological paradigm. And as Dragan mentioned, this isn't just lambda CDM. This is essentially all of our typical ideas of dark energy, where the dark energy is a smooth component that is just affecting the growth of structure through the background expansion history. So I'll go through a few of those arguments, which I'll highlight some things that are important aspects of those arguments and how general they are. And then think about if in the future, so this is, where's my pointer? So in the future, if our paradigm is tipped over, it's in a very precarious position here, but it's passed all the tests and it's very finely balanced. Things are predicted to a percent type precision, and so far they've all passed. And it's actually the theories that are the head on the track for the train oncoming from the data here. But if in the future that we see things like an excess of high redshift, high mass clusters, or even the local cluster abundance, which is actually the strongest constraints on some of these models, alternate models of gravity, in particular the F of R model, where it's a modified action model, is best tested by the local cluster abundance. And in fact, the geometric constraints aren't doing anything for you there directly. So I'll go through some of those arguments and use those fully worked examples. So it's only recently that we've gotten n-body simulations that simulate the effect of these modified forces in a realistic way, where you can hide the modified forces on small scales, on scales where we know gravity very well, like the solar system. So I'll talk a little bit about what we've learned from doing that. So here's the outline. I want to touch on how predictive our standard model of cosmology is. We've heard a lot about lambda CDM. It also includes essentially all of smooth dark energy, with some very strong tests for things like quintessence available in the data even now with testing it through clusters. And then what if this thing tips over? What could it be? We heard this morning a lot about non-Gaussianity. It could also be that we don't understand the force law on megaparsec scales. And here are a bunch of my collaborators, Dragan in particular here, who spoke on some of these issues. And a lot of them are on the job market next year, so keep an eye out for them. So what's the general argument here? The general argument is in our paradigm of smooth dark energy, where the dark energy doesn't cluster with clusters, then it's only affecting the growth of structure, the abundance of galaxy clusters and their clustering, through the expansion history. That means that all of our geometric tests, which have yielded now very, very precise constraints on the expansion history of the universe, predict what we should see for the cluster abundance, anything to do with structure like weak lensing, velocity fields. Of course, in this talk, I'll focus on the cluster aspects of things. And these have yet to be measured to the precision of the expansion history constraints. So it's an opportunity to falsify the paradigm, in particular, the smooth dark energy paradigm. So I'll remind you, geometric constraints, the things that I'll be showing you are based on combining the Union data set, Union 2 data set of supernovae, the CMB WMAP 7 baryon acoustic oscillations, both coming through the standard ruler of the sound horizon at recombination. When you pump this through an MCMC and you predict what the growth of structure should be at all redshifts, assuming first a cosmological constant. So as you know, in a cosmological constant context, this is very, very well predicted by the current measurements of expansion history of the universe. We can't have any deviations at the few percent level, otherwise the paradigm is falsified, and this includes curvature. This one actually does include curvature, so it would falsify the cosmological constant if at any redshift we saw deviations from the growth of structure anchored to the CMB microwave background peaks here at the high redshift end. As Dragan said this morning, that's not just lambda CDM, because the idea is that with a smooth dark energy paradigm, the expansion history predicts the growth of structure. And so in any model where the equation of state is greater than minus one, a quintessence model, and it's smooth on scales of the structure, clusters of galaxies in this case, there's a one-sided bound due to this W greater than minus one. So basically, you can't have more structure than lambda CDM predicts. So if you see anything at any redshift that's in excess from what you expect from lambda CDM, it rules out anything in the WZ domain. So this is through a principal components analysis that kept 10 principal components, so arbitrary variations in the equation of state below redshift of about two. And that's not just the growth of structure. So there are other things that I won't emphasize here that are also predictive that can't happen in this paradigm. So there are many opportunities to falsify our standard paradigm for cosmology. So how do you test this? You test this with things that do track the growth of structure, clusters of galaxies, of course, and weak lensing, things in the microwave background due to the change in the potential wells, the ISW effect, and redshift space distortions or anything to do with the velocity field. So let me cover this thing that's been talked about quite a lot in the conference already, and people have been showing, which is great, are the results of this analysis in a convenient fitting form. Let me just say a few words about where it came from. So in this approach of predicting observables, like the cluster abundance, what you do is you take all of these geometric constraints, you push it through a Markov chain Monte Carlo, and you make predictions for things like the number of clusters above a given mass and above a given redshift. And these predict posterior distributions given the uncertainties in cosmological parameters. How you should read this plot is that these are parameter distributions, so at 95% confidence, you want to read what sort of mass and what sort of redshift can you falsify lambda CDM if you've detected clusters, and this is at a 95% threshold, so this is, of course, a stronger degree than just saying one cluster. So this is the line for a 95% confidence. And basically, this would say that at 95%, 95%, so 95% in the parameter region, 95% in the sample variance on all sky in this case, you shouldn't see things that are greater than 2, 10 to the 15 above redshift 1. Okay, and this is just translating into the plot that many people have shown. I want to make one more comment associated with this in terms of this bias correction here. But basically, you can take anything you want for the survey area. And we've heard much discussion of this. This plot was at 300 square degrees. And make the plot of the exclusion zone of what cluster above what mass and what redshift would be in tension with all of quintessence, including lambda CDM. And we've seen this plot before. What I want to comment, so I don't actually need to advertise this because I've seen many people here use it. We have a convenient fitting formula that includes the current parameter uncertainty, so it includes whatever confidence you want to place on the cosmological parameters through these MCMC chains. As a function of survey area and the statistical errors, the sample variance errors that you want to associate with this exclusion. We have a driver code for you if you want to just download it. I do want to make one more comment since this has been well covered in the meeting. I want to make a comment about this bias correction business. So here are the raw numbers here, which are not in 300 square degrees in significant tension with the lambda CDM predictions or the quintessence predictions, and even less so if you think about this Eddington bias correction. I want to say a word about that because there are two different ways which Eddington bias corrections are used in the literature. And so this is the same thing as what Gus showed in his talk. So basically, for a plot like this, you want to be comparing essentially in the observable mass domain. So whatever your mass observable relation is, you're actually making predictions for the, not the mass function, but the observable mass function. So yx function or temperature function. And you want to account for this scattering effect, that it's a threshold in your observable mass, and that you're more likely to scatter into the sample than out of the sample. And that produces this bias. And in the sense of correcting for this bias, what it is an abundance matching criteria. So it's not trying to get the best mass given lambda CDM, right? Because we're trying to test the model, test lambda CDM. What this correction is, this specific Eddington bias correction is we've matched the abundance of things above a observable mass threshold to the abundance of above a true mass threshold. And setting those equal sets the probabilities equal. So the bias correction you get here is as if you had compared things in the observable mass domain, but it's just convenient to plot it the implications in the true mass domain, so you can put all of these data points on the same plot. The other advantage of this is that you can put in your threshold of belief for various people's error bars by not folding in all of it into an analysis that gets you one number, so you can see what people have assigned and see your level of belief about the mass observable relation errors. And this is the plot we saw this morning, that now with these larger surveys, unless you think that these SC surveys are incomplete for things that are these pink elephants, these greater than 10 to the 15 solar mass objects above redshift 1, then you would be forced to say that the area you should now consider is more in this regime, where you have 2,500 square degrees of sky search for these pink elephants, not in the 100 square degrees or the 300 square degrees. And if you were a true skeptic, what you should say is, at least we know that there is one of these guys in the full sky. So for a high threshold of disbelief of falsifiability, which I'm actually in this camp, that I would believe it, if you saw something that excluded what we should see on the whole sky, because we could have just gotten lucky, and that would be a high degree of falsifiable disbelief. Okay, so now let me turn to this testing gravity business, in that, okay, lambda CDM makes these very firm predictions, and these predictions might be falsified, but what would they be falsified in favor of? We saw that non-Gaussianity in the local type, it's hard to get the abundance of rare objects to be large and still satisfy things like the microwave background and the clustering of these rare objects on the large scales. So one possibility is that we don't understand the force law, and cosmic acceleration may be an artifact of our incomplete understanding of gravity on the large scales instead of dark energy. Or in other words, is cosmic acceleration a phenomenon like Mercury or like Pluto? That is, missing ideas in gravity or missing mass? One comment I want to make here is that unlike the solar system, we're not quite in this case where we know what the mass distribution is, and that we can have a clean test of whether it's gravity or unknown mass. So in fact, this is a little bit of a misleading way of posing it. But I want to clarify in what sense that we mean this statement. So we really mean it in the context of, is it smooth dark energy, things that don't interact with the dark matter in the baryons, or is it a modification of forces, which could include not a modification of gravity, but extra degrees of freedom changing the force law, like a scalar extra force, which is the leading example that you can come up with in the theory domain of things. And you can always think of that as not actually a modification of general relativity, but a modification, an extra force, a fifth force in the problem with general relativity. Okay, so what does that mean? That means that, like the cosmological constant, you could always push things on the left-hand side or the right-hand side of Einstein's equation and think of it as a modification of gravity or a modification of dark energy. And formally, if you didn't know anything about what the energy, matter-energy components of the universe were, you couldn't actually say that it was a modification of gravity. It obeys all of the geometric things that you like conservation laws. And you need something, some handle on the microphysics of what these energy densities could be before you can say that it's testing gravity directly and not testing an unknown component of matter energy. To be more specific, since I know most of you know this stuff, what I'm talking about is that you can phrase it this way as a test of gravity, like a PPN parameter, that would distinguish the amount of space curvature generated per dynamical mass, or essentially the lensing mass versus dynamical mass comparison. But remember, in general relativity, you can also get these effects if you have relativistic degrees of freedom in the energy sector. So anisotropic stress of matter also looks like things that would give you this. So it's really testing an assumption of what the dark energy is, in this case, smooth dark energy, which has no anisotropic stress and no significant matter density, energy density fluctuations compared with the dark matter distribution. And that's what you can test specifically. So the most model-free tests are things like testing the dynamical mass versus the lensing mass. And that goes about through thinking about extra forces that are affecting non-relativistic particles and photons seeing something else. And those are the most model-independent tests, and those go by combining things like redshift space distortions with clusters and weak lensing. But what I want to say here is that if you've changed the force law and you're following the growth of structure and you have a real model, you are still testing the model in an absolute sense by measuring things like the abundance of clusters, right? Because if I've changed the force law, I've changed how structure evolves, not just a snapshot of whether the lensing and dynamical mass are equal for a given object. Okay, so the basic idea is you modify how density sources the Newtonian potential, which moves the particles, and that changes things like the abundance of clusters. But to do this, you need some idea of what kind of alternatives are possible. How can you modify in a self-consistent way the force laws and hide it from things like solar system tests of gravity? So there are two leading ideas of how to do things like this. And they go under the name of the chameleon mechanism and the Weinstein mechanism, with two examples that you can write down, at least as a toy model, from the level of writing down in a particle physics way, a first principles way, and an action, and derive all the consequences. I don't want to dwell too much on this. They're just toy models that give you examples of a framework to think about these sorts of things. And these are the modified action model, where you replace the Ricci scalar with some general function of the Ricci scalar, in which case there's an extra scalar degree of freedom, which you could also think of as something that has a dark energy that is coupled to dark matter, if you do a so-called conformal transformation, which has a mass that depends on the field value. And so the idea of the chameleon mechanism is that the field responds to local gravitational potentials, and the field can run in a cluster of galaxies so that the mass gets larger and the force range gets smaller and hides the deviations deep inside Halo. And I'll skip all the details of that. The second way of doing it is exemplified by the DGP model, which is actually a brain world model, but there are now generalizations like the Galileian model that implement this in 4D. And basically the difference here is that this extra scalar degree of freedom is obeying a nonlinear equation that's linked to the density field. So in high density regions, you're hiding the force. And this is called the Weinstein mechanism. So what I do want to emphasize here is not the details of those specific models, but the sort of the structure of how these things work and how they end up being compatible with small-scale stuff like the solar system tests of gravity. So you might know that a lot of people are parameterizing these things as you know, an effective slip, the anisotropic stress of the modification of gravity, and the modification to the Newton's constant written here in terms of the Lenzing mass on the Lenzing potential. But this isn't really how it can work in a self-consistent model. It's not going to be that it's a fixed function of scale or a fixed function of k, and you can parameterize this and think about the linear and nonlinear regimes as just free functions that extend you in a spatial scale, because it's going to be dependent on the local environment. These two mechanisms, one is driven by the local gravitational potential. So if you're deep inside a halo, it's different from being on the outskirts of a halo, say. And likewise, if it's driven by the matter, if you're in a high density contrast, you have a different force law than in a low density contrast. The way both of these mechanisms work is that you have an extra scalar field, and that looks like a source to your Poisson equation. And this guy obeys some nonlinear equation so that either deep inside a gravitational potential well, it's suppressed, or in a high density region, it's suppressed. Okay, so this is how it works in those two examples. One is essentially a potential for the scalar field that is allowed to run and change its mass. This Ricci scalar is a function of the FR field. And in the DGP case, it's second derivatives of field with interesting symmetry properties called the Galilean invariant approach here. One's linked to the gravitational potential, one is linked to the density fluctuation. The nice thing about these two examples is that we now have n-body simulations that illustrate what's going on with these mechanisms and how you hide the extra forces deep inside a halo. So in this case, it's the F of R model, and you're looking at the density field, the Newtonian gravitational potential, and how this field nonlinearly responds to the gravitational potential in this case. And in this case, the chameleon mechanism is very effective. So even on scales of 10 to the 12 solar masses, galactic scale masses, you're able to hide the extra forces inside the halos. If you go in terms of a very large background field, well, the field response is of order the gravitational potential. So in this case, the chameleon mechanism only affects clusters of galaxies. It's very stiff in the field, and you would not see this hiding of the force in, say, our galaxy. So let's get back to the cluster side of things. So if you are in this large field regime, and in fact, that's where the constraints are today. So you enhance by a factor of order unity the abundance of local clusters. This is Z of zero. And this is the best constraint, cosmological constraint on this model currently. Right? So in this case, the deviations of the expansion history are of order 10 to the minus 4 in the equation of state, impossible to observe currently and impossible to observe in the future, and it's yet producing order unity deviations in the abundance of clusters. So with Alexei and Fabian Schmidt, we converted this into the cosmological constraints on this model, and you don't have to really worry about the parameters of this model. The clusters are the best constraint. It depends on the redshift evolution of these modified forces. This is an inverse curvature model, so this is the scaling index of the inverse curvature. And you can take, in a simple rescaling, one model and remap it to another model and see the constraints on a whole variety of these modified action models in terms of either the field amplitude, which remember is the thing that you want to keep track of for solar system tests, whether this is of order the gravitational potential in the galaxy and the sun, and in terms of the range of force, whether you're probing 10 megaparsecs or 100 megaparsecs modifications of the force law. Now, I have to say that our constraints from cosmology are not yet directly competitive with solar system constraints, right? So if you want to hide these forces even in our halo, which has a 10 to the minus 6 potential, and you want to think of this F of R model as extending all the way from cosmological scales to solar system scales, we're getting close to the solar system bounds, but we're not yet exceeding them. And the comment I want to make there is that we're close, and as we do better and better on the clusters, the excess is actually popping up on the group scale. So if you can push the mass function down, you can in mass and test this regime and still get reliable mass proxies, you can actually make statements that are very, very complementary to solar system constraints, even directly, directly comparable in the context of a model, even though solar system constraints are extremely precise. And I'll flash up some work of a student in trying to model these effects, the chameleon effects. And we have a prescription where it's just one extra parameter you throw in, and it scales in a known way with different F of R models, the chameleon mass scale, and looking at the abundance of down the mass function. You can do this for the Weinstein mechanism, and I'll skip over that because I can see I'm out of time, and give you the summary. So given the geometric data, even currently, our cosmological paradigm of smooth dark energy with an equation of state that's not a phantom is highly predictive and falsifiable, especially in predicting no excess structure in the universe. So lambda CDM puts essentially a firm upper bound within a few percent on what the growth of structure is at any redshift, given what we know of the initial conditions from the microwave background and the distance redshift relation. That includes things like pink elephants, but using a sort of conservative approach for having to have very strong evidence to falsify lambda CDM, I would say no single cluster falsifies lambda CDM. And in the future, if something does indicate pink elephants, or more generally, as we've seen, the local cluster abundance, or the high redshift abundance of not the rarest guy, but the whole mass function, then it could be that we don't understand the force laws, and it's easy to get scalar field models that enhance forces with the same background expansion history, so this could be an explanation. What's harder is to make them all compatible with what we know about gravity locally. The mechanisms we know about are to link it to the gravitational potential in the galaxy and in the solar system, or the density field. And currently, for the F of R model, which is linked to the gravitational potential, the strongest cosmological constraint is from the local cluster abundance. And so the more general lesson that you should take away from this is if you're doing parameterized approaches and you're trying to be realistic about how modifications of gravity can work, you should make them dependent on the local environment, not some global function fixed length scale, but they have to be things that respond to the local environment, the local density, or the local potential. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Wayne. Questions? Halima?
So Actually, to my first question is, one thing that I've seen is people either testing non-Gaussianity, assuming lambda CDM, or testing lambda CDM, but assuming Gaussianity.
Right.
And then how do all the constraints get degenerate when you have both?
Yeah, I think there's some interesting things to say about that. Certainly in the context of these models where you want to be able to satisfy ordinary gravity at high redshift because the microwave background is very, very precise now. So the redshift dependence is going to be very different in these alternate ways of thinking. So in these cases, you would actually expect the enhancement at the same rarity of objects. Say you were looking at the same peaks in the Gaussian initial conditions. So these being Gaussian and changing the force law. You would expect that the high redshift enhancements are less than the low redshift enhancements because we're modifying forces to explain cosmic acceleration in this case, right? So there, I think, there's opportunities to compare the rarest objects at low and high redshifts, for example.
Just briefly, if we found a deviation from W of minus one, for example, are we actually opening up more of a Pandora's box? Because now instead of removing one parameter that requires fine-tuning, we are actually increasing the number of parameters that require fine-tuning with modified gravity?
Sure. So the approach I took here is to say that even with all these degrees of freedom, you can't predict things that are in excess of lambda CDM. So that's one statement. Of course, if you saw something lower and you threw in 10 free parameters to explain a lack of clusters, for example, then there's a threshold of disbelief. There's Occam's razor for that. And that's certainly true. You'd want to do something like Bayesian evidence to see whether you were really convinced if you were doing a Bayesian analysis or at least a chi-squared per degree of freedom. But the interesting thing is that if it's on the other side, you can't even explain it. So it doesn't matter what you throw in for WZ.
Far from me from saying that you can use a single cluster to rule out lambda CDM at this point. However, in the spirit of doing things correctly, you show XMM2235 in that plot, and you just arbitrarily took 300 square degree as a save area. It's not 300, it's 50. It's not going to get bigger than that, 1, 2.
But
there is a precise 50% increased systematics estimate of the mass, and there you use the, this comes from direct X-ray and weak lensing and strong lensing measurement. There you just use a scaling relation, it's a factor 2 or more below. The error bar is a factor 4 larger. So
it's mainly the error bars, I think.
But anyway, no, also the mass.
Let me address the area comment. So I will punt this to my SZ collaborators, but you would have to argue that they're seriously incomplete on these at these masses and these redshifts. And I think the discussion yesterday.
So what? It's 50 square degrees, not 300. If it's square degree, that's the probability.
Oh yes, but in terms of combining it for a cosmological constraint, they are not finding one of these guys per every 50 square degrees. So in terms of a joint analysis, the number that you should take, unless you believe they're very seriously incomplete, is 2,500 square degrees. I just showed the example from the paper where we took 300 square degrees, but the Williams et al. Thing, I think, is the curve you want to look at.